Good evening, welcome. We're going to be talking about conflict, substance use, and HIV. And I'd first like to say something about kind of the study of global health generally. What constitutes the study of global health varies quite substantially from one university to another, one program to another, one form of research to another. At some universities, the focus may be on border health in the United States. At others still, it may be on sub-Saharan Africa. At others, Eastern Europe. At others, migrant populations within the United States. This analysis is truly global. It uses state-level data from disparate sources that I've put together and incorporates over 177 World Health Organization member states. So a little different than the area-specific studies you might see elsewhere at APHA this year. So when we explore the relationship between conflict and HIV, we're addressing several important questions. Should conflict-affected states be targeted and prioritized for interventions, even if this may mean that finite resources may be diverted from countries that have ongoing epidemics but are not affected by conflict? Or, if we can't find evidence of a direct relationship between conflict and HIV, perhaps we can develop and test models that explore the mechanisms through which conflict exerts its influence on HIV, thus providing us with important precision in how global resources can be distributed to reduce HIV. So with this in mind, the overall goal of this research study is to develop and test an exploratory model linking conflict from 2002 to 2008 and its longer-term impact on HIV morbidity and mortality in 2010 among 177 World Health Organization member states. So again, we're looking at state-level data here. This study is novel because it incorporates best available data on social, economic, demographic, and health determinants of HIV, some of which have only begun to become available in the last decade or so. It also places an emphasis on alcohol use and illicit substance use beyond injection drug use as major intervening variables through which conflict potentially impacts HIV morbidity and mortality. So how can this research be useful to people working on the ground, to NGOs, to peacekeepers, state governments, or even private entities working in global health? Well, foremost, I believe it provides a clear approach to understanding how conflict impacts HIV morbidity and mortality by theorizing and exploring causal pathways. Second, it underscores what I call the hidden costs of conflict. So typically when you're looking at conflict studies or disaster studies, the emphasis is placed on the immediate to short term. Is there a risk of cholera? What vital economic infrastructures have been destroyed and are in need of repair? However, as we see in the case of both conflict and disaster alike, there are longer-term costs and circumstances that require a shift in perspective towards longer-term development of infrastructure and health programming to meet the immediate as well as the evolving needs of conflict-affected populations. So overall, what this study seeks to do is to foremost identify conflict-affected populations at risk for increased HIV morbidity and mortality, and to help develop evidence-based HIV prevention and intervention approaches in conflict-affected states. As we know, this is the HIV section. HIV continues to be a significant public health problem, claiming more than 39 million lives to date. In 1990, the virus was listed as 33rd among top causes of morbidity and mortality combined worldwide, and by 2010, it jumped to fifth, representing a 335% increase. So by the end of 2010, there were approximately 34 million people living with HIV, with 2.1 million people becoming newly infected each year. And importantly, while some countries have previously seen HIV decline, some are seeing it go up again, all while funding for some programs remains stagnant or is declining. So what this tells us is that we need to become increasingly efficient and creative with how we study and manage HIV in a global context. So the outcome measure in this study are disability-adjusted life years, or DALYs, attributable to HIV in 2010 among these 177 World Health Organization member countries. So some here may be familiar with DALYs, but to put it fairly briefly, They are a summary measure of health that combines information on both morbidity and mortality, which is important since we're talking about prevention and intervention strategies. So among those factors most often cited as contributing to the global HIV epidemic is armed conflict. So we've seen in the news most recently with the case of Syria and others, and we know from a diverse and broad interdisciplinary literature that conflict affects people in many different ways, economically, socially, culturally, and through health. However, lower to middle income fragile or conflict affected countries remain the most significantly impacted by both conflict and HIV. So what we see is that slightly more than a quarter of the world's population live in countries impacted by fertility and conflict, yet 33% of deaths from HIV occur in conflict-affected states. One-third of the 14 million children who have lost at least one parent to HIV live in conflict-affected countries, and when it comes to meeting the grand challenges in health globally, one of the major sticking points is doing so in conflict-affected and fragile countries. And in fact, only 15% of conflict-affected countries meet the UN Millennium Development Goal to reduce new cases of HIV by 2015. So while it's clear that conflict plays an important role in health outcomes globally, the empirical literature supporting the association between conflict and HIV is sparse. Some scholars have found no evidence of an association between conflict and HIV, while others have found strong and positive associations between conflict and HIV prevalence, citing numerous explanations, including population displacement, changes in sexual behavior, including increased instances of rape, increased instances of transactional sex and lower condom use, as well as disruption of healthcare infrastructure and attacks on AIDS workers. So taken together, the existing literature suggests that conflict does not directly and in all cases lead to increased prevalence of HIV, but could rather be more accurately viewed as a risk factor for the spread of HIV. But the question becomes, why do some conflict-affected states experience increased HIV morbidity and mortality while others do not? So again, given this and employing the most current data available on global measures of economic, social, political, and health outcomes, there needs to be a movement beyond the traditional multivariate risk factor analyses towards identification of putative causal pathways between conflict and HIV morbidity and mortality. Now, critical in the study of conflict and health is the observation that the nature and scope of conflict itself has changed significantly over time, and this is one of the major reasons why this study focuses on the period of 2002 to 2008, and previous research by myself and my colleagues focused on the period of 1994 to 2000. So since 1990, conflicts have increasingly become civil or internal armed conflicts between a state and one or more armed opposition groups. And in fact, in this period of observation, less than 2% of conflict years were internal armed conflict. Further, conflict has changed to increasingly include terrorist events and one-sided violence. One-sided violence being acts of violence by the state against civilian entities, whether we're talking about genocide, some re-execution of prisoners, violence against the media, and other forms of violence. And so because these acts occur so frequently together, the evidence strongly suggests that these forms of violence are closely related and should be studied together rather than separately. So for this study, the sum of deaths due to civil war and one-sided violence were used and were derived from databases from Uppsala University, while terrorist death data was derived from the global terrorism data from the University of Maryland. So one conceptual methodological advance, as just mentioned, is that previous studies had typically looked at civil war or interstate violence deaths, but failed to include one-sided violence and terrorist activities within the same context. So we know injection drug use is strongly associated with HIV through shared needle use and risky sexual behaviors. And this has caused injection drug users to be commonly designated as most at-risk populations, along with men who have sex with men, sex workers and their clients, and at times prisoners, deserving of special attention and increased resources for services and surveillance. So globally, about 16 million persons are estimated to inject illicit drugs, and injection and drug use accounts for about 10% of new HIV infections each year, while outside of sub-Saharan Africa, Injection drug use accounts for about 30% of these new HIV infections. So although attention is given to injection drug use and its relationship to HIV, a significant gap in the literature is the failure to focus on the relationship to alcohol use and non-injection drug use and HIV through mechanisms of risky sexual behaviors. So a second conceptual and methodological advance is therefore broadening our view of substance use beyond injection drug use, while still maintaining injection drug use within this drug use framework. So as previously mentioned, this research moves beyond a simple risk factor approach that has been proven to have poor predictive and explanatory power to explain the conflict HIV association. Instead, theoretical models using structural equation modeling are developed to explain the conflict HIV association, and to do this, identify two sets of factors through which conflict may influence HIV morbidity and mortality. So at first, we have two susceptibility constructs. Susceptibility constructs are hypothesized as potential mediators and are measured as existing during baseline or as pre-existing background factors. So these variables are anticipated to change either the strength or direction of the relationship between conflict and HIV. While the single vulnerability construct is hypothesized as a mediator or factors that reflect conflict-induced changes. And so these factors are anticipated to account for the relationship between conflict and HIV. So let's take a look at some of the factors that make up these constructs, and we'll go into them in greater detail. So the first susceptibility construct, which we might call background risk, includes baseline HIV prevalence, ethnic heterogeneity, and a measure of those affected by natural disasters. A second susceptibility construct includes alcohol consumption, non-injection drug use drug prevalence, and injection drug use prevalence. While the single vulnerability construct includes the number of refugees, total HIV spending in each country, and the number of people on antiretroviral therapy. So here we see the hypotheses related to our first susceptibility construct, that is background risk. And again, the pre-existing background factors may directly impact HIV morbidity and mortality in the longer term, or they may moderate the conflict HIV relationship. So baseline prevalence of many diseases, particularly communicable ones, and in this case HIV, is an important epidemiologic parameter that often directly predicts future illness and death from the disease or condition. So therefore, it's hypothesized that baseline HIV prevalence will directly impact longer-term HIV morbidity and mortality. However, conditions of conflict, malnutrition, population displacement, predatory sexual behaviors may increase the pool of those infected by HIV and therefore serve as a moderator of the HIV, the conflict HIV association. Data on HIV prevalence among adults aged 15 to 49 in the years 2002 were available from the UNAIDS Millennium Development Goals database. Ethnic heterogeneity within a country is another factor that can directly influence HIV morbidity and mortality in the longer term through inequality in access to political power and economic resources, which in turn could lead to unequal access in health services, treatment, and education. Alternatively, ethnic heterogeneity may moderate the conflict HIV association in the longer term through mechanisms of sexual violence towards women. The ethnic heterogeneity variable was derived from data collected by Van Hannon and colleagues and combines racial, linguistic, and religious division, each measured as a percentage of the largest group of the country's population through the year 2000. So natural disasters and conflicts share a lot of features and consequences, and have been commonly classified together as complex emergencies since the 1990s, and more recently as big events, to go along with the trend in big data. So like conflict, disasters have been linked directly to increased morbidity and mortality from HIV in the longer term. However, there's an emerging literature on how natural disasters may moderate the conflict HIV association by altering the dynamics of conflict. So a growing literature is highlighting now how conflict-affected and fragile countries share a dual burden of both conflict and natural disaster experiences. And these experiences may have destabilizing effects on governments and subpopulations, but particularly destabilize health services and infrastructure in a given country. So alcohol and illicit drug use, particularly injection drug use, have been linked to the transmission of HIV through mechanisms of high-risk drug use and risky sexual behaviors. However, recent theoretical formulations have outlined how substance use as susceptibility factors can interact with conditions of conflict to influence HIV morbidity and mortality in the longer term. So these conditions can include, for example, the expansion and growth and alterations to the illicit drug trade within a given country. So for this analysis, per capita alcohol consumption for each country was gathered from World Health Organization data, as was country-level data for illicit drug use. Non-injection drug use was calculated as the sum of prevalences of illicit drug use related to cannabis, opiates, and cocaine. I wish we had more data for different drugs, but this is what the UN is collecting the data for right now. So here we see the final vulnerability construct, again hypothesized to mediate the conflict-HIV relationship. So many studies have documented the relationship between conflict and refugees, of course, and highlighted their vulnerability to HIV as a result of family disintegration, social disruption, increased sexual risk behaviors, and sexual violence. A major hypothesis of this study, then, is that the number of refugees, asylum seekers, and displaced persons will mediate the conflict-HIV relationship. So the number of refugees, asylum seekers, and displaced persons in thousands residing in each host country at the end of the year 2008 was available from the UN High Commissioner for Refugee Statistical Database. Now, increased spending on HIV programs, including ART, should lead to a reduction in HIV morbidity and mortality, but there's a number of reasons why an influx of resources may actually increase morbidity and mortality from HIV, especially in the years of study. So HIV response in conflict-affected states remains largely ad hoc, and guidelines are generally vague and imprecise. Coordination is lacking among donors, the states embroiled in the conflicts or having previously experienced the conflicts, humanitarian agencies, and other actors involved in these issues. So beyond issues of coordination and planning is a significant issue where HIV-related funds often don't make it to most at-risk populations, but are instead spread broadly across the general population, largely due to issues of social stigmas and politics. This is despite strong and effective treatments and evidence of low-cost interventions aimed at most at-risk populations. And finally and briefly, drug resistance may slow reductions in HIV morbidity and mortality anticipated by national spending on HIV reduction programs. We see this in low, middle, and high-income countries alike. And data on drug resistances is increasingly available, thankfully, from the United Nations UNAIDS data. So here we see the whole model together. We're going to be able to see this model again when we do the structural model assessment and derive our path coefficients. But it's good to see here in the center our two susceptibility constructs, again, hypothesized as potential moderators. And on the bottom, our single vulnerability construct, hypothesized to be a potential mediator. So this study utilized partial least square structural equation modeling. And so this methodology is an alternative to covariance fitting approaches and is component-based. So PLSM is ideal in situations where you have a sample size of less than 200, and here we have a sample size of 177 WHO member states in the study. It's excellent in situations where constructs can be defined with multiple indicators, that is more than one or two indicators. It's best suited for purposes of theory building, whereas covariance-based structural equation modeling is most suitable for theory testing. And finally, PLSM does not require multivariate normality to produce consistent parameters, but instead uses a bootstrap resampling procedure to test the stability of the estimates. So to put it briefly, the bootstrap procedure draws repeated random samples, in this case 5,000 from the data, in order to estimate standard errors and calculate t-statistics for inferential purposes. So importantly, bootstrapping is a powerful tool for detecting, moderating, and mediating effects. So we're not going to spend too much time on the first step of PLSM, but you're always going to be interested in the reliability and validity of your indicator variables and constructs. So examining individual indicator reliability, with few exceptions, the factor loadings were greater than the 0.70 benchmark. However, some suggest using a 0.50 benchmark when doing theory building endeavors, which we're doing here. Conversion validity showed that the average variance extracted for each construct was greater than the 0.50 benchmark. And analyzing discriminant validity, the average variance extracted was greater than the variance shared between the latent construct and each of the other constructs in the model. But now we get to the meat and potatoes. So the second step of PLSM is the structural model assessment. Now what you see from the leading outward from the oval constructs to the individual rectangular indicators are the factor loadings between the indicators and their putative constructs. And as can be seen, they're all very high, with the individual path coefficients, all but four, being above 0.70. So the path coefficients between the constructs and HIV DALYs in the top right corner can be interpreted as standardized coefficients of ordinary least squares regression. So in PLSM, moderation is shown by significant interaction between the susceptibility factors and conflict. And so the results first show that the construct we call pre-existing background factors does not moderate the conflict HIV association, but instead directly serves to increase DALYs attributable to HIV in the longer term. However, we did find that the second susceptibility construct, substance use, does serve as a moderator. So that is, the conflict HIV association is stronger when the rate of substance use is greater. I can't read that, by the way. Okay. So finally, in PLSM, mediation is shown by significant relationships between conflict and vulnerability in HIV DALYs, but no direct relationship between conflict and HIV DALYs. So what we see then is that the vulnerability construct was found to mediate the conflict HIV association. So I kind of quickly want to go over these conclusions and recommendations, because it's a significant problem, but we can derive a significant amount of hope from things that are happening around the world today. So among all states, we have to scale up HIV prevention and intervention efforts to align with pre-existing HIV burden. Sounds common sense, but in many situations, the money often doesn't go where the disease is. Fostering political will, politics still plays a role. One thing that you won't see too much at APHA are political science folks, journalism folks, how we can better interact with these people to solve problems, particularly on a global scale, is important. We see in the case of the Philippines right now, a long-standing conflict, perhaps hopefully coming to an end through politics. Finally, reducing the impact of natural disasters on the populace is also important in reducing future HIV morbidity and mortality, even simple things such as, for example, tsunami warning systems in Southeast Asia. Among conflict-affected states, integrating substance use prevention and harm reduction programs in national HIV responses and plans, as well as scaling up substance use prevention and harm reduction programs, even small things such as brief interventions, provision of needles and syringes, and on. And finally, just one or two more slides. Among conflict-affected states, UN and WHO are taking charge in improving multi-agency response. You can imagine in conflict-affected or ongoing conflict situations, it's extremely difficult to organize people to work in the field. But focusing and targeting MARPs is critical, most at-risk populations, rather than broadly focusing your efforts on a general population. And finally, additionally, focusing on populations displaced by conflict is important. And extremely quickly, working towards reducing morbidity and mortality during HIV and TB drug resistance is an emerging problem, which means we need to increase surveillance of transmitted HIV drug resistance and monitor early warnings and indicators of HIV drug resistance, particularly in conflict-affected states. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to our presenters. So we have a few minutes for questions. So if you want to raise your hand, stand and direct your question to someone. Well, I can start with a question to give you guys some more time to think about it. So for Dr. Carriage, a wonderful presentation. So it's obvious that countries in conflict are more susceptible to adverse health outcomes because of destabilization of the government and health structures. And I'm wondering if you or your colleagues has been doing any work with regard to the Ebola outbreak. I did some work in Sierra Leone last spring, and which I'll be presenting on tomorrow morning at 8:30 if anybody's interested. A lot of people don't know that Sierra Leone is still recovering from a civil war that started in the 90s. So I'm just wondering if that's something that's been working on in your department or on anybody's radar to look into and research about how that conflict kind of drove the Ebola outbreak and, you know, magnified it just because of the health structures and the government structures that weren't really in place when that started.
Right, and I think that these kind of factors were taken into consideration by friends and colleagues who work at PCC when making projections of potential cases and when assessing what the potential need were for setting up hospitals and whatnot. They had to take into account which areas had the least infrastructure for managing the situation. I don't specifically work with Ebola, and I haven't done any particular work with Ebola myself. But I think that the same issues apply. You want to take into consideration the same factors. Are there refugee populations or displaced populations? What is the situation with those most vulnerable? So with HIV, you're looking at MARS, but when you're looking at most vulnerable populations for Ebola, it would be individuals living in the most dense urban centers, and you would have to take into account those such factors.
Right.
This project is a theoretical framework for potentially other diseases. The hope is that people can take their specific expertise and apply it at increasing specificity. So, for example, with the case of Ebola, you would be interested in demographers. And GIS experts might be interested in population movement. So one of the biggest issues when the Ebola case first broke out was how many people are moving between countries, how can the disease spread from one country to another, how can we estimate cross-border travel, which is why many countries weren't able to do so because they closed borders, didn't allow people to travel. I think everyone can play a role, economists, demographers, GIS, can play a role in adding additional specificity and indicators for the relevant disease outcome.
Thank you. Can I? Oh, sure.
For the audience first?
Oh, sure. Any other questions? And you want to say something, Dr. Pitt?
Yeah, related to the refugee movement and for the population of refugee population, can you look at the level, the percentage of proportion from the sending perspective or receiving perspective?
Right.
Perspective, do you actually distinguish that? Yeah.
Right, and so there's two ways to look at it, as you said. We looked at it as in where they're hosted.
Yeah.
Where they're hosted. You can also look at it from where they're coming from. And so then in turn, that would serve as a proxy for how destabilized the country is. If you have a million people leaving one country, then the argument goes that that country is significantly destabilized compared to some other country, and you should expect increased disease. However, what we were hoping to show is, are refugees themselves vulnerable to disease, and they are in being hosted somewhere else. And so one issue that I know the World Health and other organizations are focused on constantly is how to protect vulnerable refugee populations being hosted in different countries from the spread of disease, substance use, sexual attacks, and whatnot. So we focused on where they were hosted rather than where they came from. I mean, in the future, I would love for someone to put together a more specific data set on how much damage is actually taking place in the country, how much that, even if just an economic estimate, more specific data on where the specific conflicts were occurring within a country. So we can say is it primarily urban, primarily rural, this kind of thing. But someone else has to do that.
And also you have multiple years here, for example, for we'll just use the proportion, the number of refugee populations, for example. If you actually average data across years from 2002 to 2008, or you actually use the specific year, because the population are moving, right?
Right. And so in this case, we use them at the end period, so in 2008. And so future studies, what we're interested in doing is, because galleons come out every couple of years, we're interested in kind of looking at how conflict differentially affects health outcomes in different periods of time. So did conflicts in the 90s affect HIV differently than conflicts in the 2000s? And then in this sense, we can look at different levels of refugees over the years and whatnot as well. So this was just looking at a single time point of refugees at the end point of the period of occupation for the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, thanks again, Dr. Mendes.